everyone, and welcome to Celebrating Cinema, a podcast for the love of cinema. I'm your host, Laura Holmans, and I'm here with film critic Hugo Emmertzau.
Hey, everybody.
And our producer, Elliot Bloom.
Hello, hello.
On this episode, we discuss Park Chan-wook's new movie, No Other Choice. You know the director from his masterpieces like Old Boy and The Handmaiden, and this time he tackles the devastating effects of capitalism on a family in South Korea. We're also going to briefly travel back to the Overlook Hotel as we reflect on 45 years of Stanley Kubrick's The Shining.
Ooh.
Mark the 15th of February in your calendars because we have two cool events happening here at Lab 111 in Amsterdam. First, we're showing Tarsem Singh's The Fall in a drink-along screening. What is a drink-along screening, you ask? Well, our Bar Strange Love sommelier boss will accompany the movie with a selection of alcoholic and non-alcoholic drinks that pair with whatever you see or feel throughout the movie. Also, film journalist Kevin Thoma of the Volkskrant will give a lecture on The Shining, delving deeper into Kubrick's masterpiece, exploring how you construct a cinematic haunted hotel. Afterwards, you can watch the movie, of course. Also, check out our program, Brazil Beneath the Surface, a collection of films that trace the hidden structure shaping Brazilian society, with classics like City of God and Central do Brasil, to coincide with the release of Oscar-nominated The Secret Agent. Hugo, how are you?
That's a big question.
It's a big question. How have you been?
I'm doing very good. I will say something that I've been watching recently that made me very happy, which is, again, a series. It seems like I'm never watching...
Oh, God, not Emily in Paris, too.
No. It seems like I'm never watching films anymore, but I'm very obsessed with The Pit on Max.
Oh, my God.
The hospital series with Noah Weil.
Tell me about it.
So insanely cool. We're now in the second season, right? It's already two seasons in. It's in Pittsburgh, the ER, the emergency room. People come in with all of these, you know, devastating accidents and other, let's say, very life-threatening situations. And you have all of these doctors and nurses rushing to fix all of these people. And the cool thing about the series is that it is so relentlessly realistic and hurried, and that you're like really in the chaos of all of these things. It's very pleasing to me because I think all of us occasionally experience stress at work and you're like, oh, why am I working so much? I see Laura sighing.
I mean, I'm very aware that I'm a podcaster.
Yeah,
people doing important stuff.
Such a heavy job. Exactly. And that's the cool thing is that it's somewhat very pleasing to see people doing actual, really important hard work. And even though the series is occasionally disgusting because you have this like very realistic depictions of gnarly stuff happening to the human body, it really sedates me in a very pleasant way because I can just kind of...
This makes so much sense for you as a person.
Because I can just kind of relax and see all of these professionals who are incredible at their job do so much more insane stuff than I would ever be able to dreaming of doing.
I can't watch it because I'm an enormous hypochondriac and I always have like... I'm always like stressed out about something's going to happen to me. So I came home one time and my boyfriend was watching this. I was like, what are we watching? And he's like, The Pit. And then someone immediately like gets a heart attack. And I was like, we have to turn this off because now I'm just going to be waiting to get a heart attack or get this like insane injury. And like, I can't do it. I would love to, but I can't do hospital stuff.
But I will just say for the hypochondriacs that what I also think is great that it inspires a lot of confidence in medical workers because there's people coming in there and you think like, no, they're done for, but they actually get fixed, you know? So it's like, I there's always constantly this shimmer of hope. And very briefly, to not go in spoiler territory, but I am watching a bit ahead because screeners. But there's some stuff happening in season two that is so incredibly relevant for the current cultural, political climate in the US right now about, let's say, all the awful stuff that the government is doing also in Minnesota and Minneapolis.
They
are capturing the zeitgeist in very strong ways. It's a very impressive series, so I'm enjoying this a lot. And it's literally giving me life.
Oh my God.
And
beautiful.
How about you, Laura?
What I've been watching... I went to London last week for the premiere of Is This Thing On? And I'm happy to report that Bradley Cooper's facelift has settled.
Congratulations to Bradley Cooper.
So that was nice. But yeah, I think when we're recording this, it's been about a week since the Oscar nominations dropped, and I always make myself watch everything that's nominated for Oscars. So I had to do it. I had to watch F1.
And congratulations.
Hold your horses. I didn't want to go see it when it came out because I don't care about Cargo Fast. Like, I really don't. And I was like, well, fuck, it got nominated for Best Picture, miraculously, Apple Money. So I was like, okay, I'm going to have to do it. So we have Apple TV. So I was like, cool, I'm locking myself in the bedroom. My partner's already seen it, so I'm going to do this. 45 minutes in, I come out, I was like, I don't know if I can do this, man. Like, I don't give a shit. The dialogue is so hammy. And then my partner went, what do you think happens next? So I go, well, I think this and this and this and this and this happens. And then probably some of this and then probably this happens. And he goes, yeah, you're bang on. That's exactly what happens. And then he kind of told me the nuances of what happens in the story of like, well, he thinks cars should go fast together as a team and cars should go fast for the kid, who like the young kid. And he's so, and then I was like, cool, now I feel like I've seen the movie. I don't think I'll finish watching it.
I watched it and I enjoyed it more than most, I think, because it's somewhat miraculously made in between all of these actual Formula One races. I also watched it for another reason, which is that this director, Joseph Kosinski, is slated to do the new version of Miami Vice.
Right.
So I had to watch it, and it actually inspires a lot of confidence because I think he can pull it off.
Nice.
He knows how to do the cool, spectacular digital cinematography.
And that, I will have to say, technically, even in those first 45 minutes, technically, I get that it gets all the technical awards. Amazing. However, Best Picture. Oh, maybe we should briefly talk about what we think of the Oscar nominations, because I think there's several snubs and there's several things that I would not put in there.
Mm.
So I think Best Picture, Formula One, I probably wouldn't put in there based
It's a bit of an odd duckling, you know?
Yeah. And I think Frankenstein didn't really hit with me in a way that I think it did for the Academy. What did you think of that one?
I love Frankenstein because I think it's like the thematic fruition of everything that Guillermo del Toro wants to do in his entire career, which is to investigate what is the relationship between humanity and the monsters they create, right? And what does it mean to be a monster and to be a human? And then to take Mary Shelley's very good book, by the way, it's easily taken for granted, but it is one of my favorite books of all time.
Yeah.
And then actually go to the core of what the key themes of his oeuvre are. I think it was very sweet and delicate, and I love Jacob Elordi in it very much. So I'm a Frankenstein defender.
Anyone who's heard that podcast episode where I'm crying about Sorry Baby, I really think it's a shame that it didn't get anything, because I do think I asked the TikTok people what their favorite movie of 2025 was, and like if you could recommend one movie, and like an overwhelming amount of people also said Sorry Baby. I don't know, I realize that she's a first-time director,
yeah,
first-time screenwriter, like she'll probably get there. I just think that movie hit home with a lot of people in a way. Like, I feel like this just happens when studios don't put enough money on a movie, like happened last year with Sing Sing, where it's like, oh yeah, it'll just completely fly under the radar if there's not like a big bag of cash to back up the campaign.
No, it would be cool to talk about this, like economic constructions of these awards at some point, because it is super interesting how much of it is a money and publicity game.
Mm-hmm.
I will just say that the biggest snub for me was in the music category, the score for Marty Supreme by Daniel Lobatin, which is quite insane that he's not there. But as a whole, I think it's kind of okay. If you see all of these films like this, I'm not going to pretend that it was the best of years, but I am hyped to see who's going to win. And I enjoyed most of these movies that are in the big categories. So as a whole, I think I am completely fine with whatever is going to go down.
Absolutely. We're looking forward to it. No Other Choice is the long-awaited South Korean black comedy slash thriller by Park Chan-wook. We follow Yoo Man-soo, played by Lee Byung-hun, who's dedicated a quarter century of his life to working at a paper factory. He really has it all, a good job, a loving family, a gorgeous home. But when the company is bought by Americans, the company has, quote-unquote, no other choice but to make some drastic cuts, including Man-soo's job. That lands him in a dramatic downward spiral, leaving him again no other choice but to eliminate his competitors in the cutthroat paper industry. Here's a clip, which is great if you speak Korean.
여보.
이 집.
내가 얼쭉 여기서 얼쭉 추억이 얼마나.
What did you think, Hugo?
I saw the film when it premiered in Venice, and you know, I like it to the biggest degree a lot, because this is a film in which you see all the best qualities of Park Chan-wook, which is mostly that he is an incredible stylist who has such an insane mastery of the audiovisual form. The way that the film is shot and edited just completely blew my mind.
Absolutely.
However, I would say on a slightly critical note that it also shows some of Park Chan-wook's, let's say for me, lesser tendencies, which is that his narratives always kind of expand and expand itself to the point that I am like at some point resisting almost how long the story takes to go a bit deeper and deeper and deeper and all of these sides.
Oh, it's funny that you say that.
I found myself a bit less locked in than I wanted. So I am on, let's say, a very appreciative, although nuanced level, enjoying this film. But that it is an excellent work of one of the great masters currently working in cinema, I think it is very clear when you see the film.
Yeah.
How about you? You were blown away a bit more?
I really, really loved it. I think that exact thing that you mentioned about Park Chan-wook's stories always going like, here's a little thing, and then we go boom, 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 and we make it 1,000 times bigger and deeper than you thought it was going to be. That is exactly what I love about his work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the rabbit
hole.
Because
I always feel like I'm in good hands. It's like, okay, on the surface, this is a story of someone losing their job. Cool. However, it just keeps snowballing to an extent where it deals with capitalism in such a way that it's like on the surface very evident. Like an American company buys this Korean company and this happens. What I love is that this character keeps, who's like, I've dedicated my life to these Korean principles of you dedicate your life to this company, the company will take care of you. He starts following the principles of capitalism himself.
Yeah.
And I think it just says a lot through that medium of expanding. It just says a lot about like how we on a personal level deal with the cutthroat capitalism thing of like the winner takes it all. And on top of that, I thought this was very enjoyable. I think it's his most humorous movie.
It's very funny. And that's also, I think when I was watching it, I felt a bit of resistance by all of these asides he takes in the narrative. However, I have to say, I saw it in Venice, right? That's a long time ago.
You were tired.
And no, well, sure. But that's, you can say that about every film at some point that you watch at the film festival. That should not be the problem in itself. But looking back at the film, it grows. Because of how funny it is.
Yeah.
It's such a cheeky, sly, funny and nasty film.
Yeah.
In like, if I just think about his dedication to the paper industry, right? And how much love he has for this and how much his identity is basically based on that he's a paper man,
he's
as they call it.
Guy. He's a paper man of the year.
And I low-key get it because there's these very nice shots where he has this stick that you use to check if the paper that's being printed in these gigantic machines is of good quality, and you have to bend the paper, and if it, you know,
gives it a good tap,
and if the sound is nice and the feel is good, then you know the paper is great.
Yeah, it's an art and a craft.
And I just sometimes have to think about this, like him tapping the paper, and I don't know why, but it really stuck with me. And then just that tenderness for paper, how that translates to the violence that he's ready to bestow on other people in this typical Park Chan-wook manner where apparently very normal people are capable of doing the most heinous crimes.
Yeah,
it's impressive. And then what I also like is that it's a story that really festers because there's literally secrets hidden under the ground that are buried and they start to kind of like rot and become, you know, a moral rot as well. And the way that this just kind of like has to go back to the surface and you know that it's going to be bad, but in what way you're not quite sure. I have very fond memories boundaries of these particular elements, for sure.
Yeah, and what I like about all those elements is that they all have to do with saving face, and like, God forbid we tumble down from middle class. Like, that's, he talks about how his grandfather used to own a pig farm, and like, look at us, like, we made it out, we are middle class, keeping up appearances. And once he starts committing all these crimes, at some point you notice that the whole family is kind of participating in this. There's a little subplot that's not really a big spoiler, but his son robs a store yes. with his friend. Yes. And the first thing that Mansu does is go, it was your friend, right? It was your friend yes. that convinced you to yes. do it. You have no responsibility in this. It's just you had no other choice. You had no other choice. And that sentence keeps getting repeated. And what I love about its commentary on capitalism is that you so often feel that you have no other choice, but there is another choice.
Yes.
And the way that basically he takes out all of his competitors almost feels like an HR choice. Like he looks at their resumes, he circles their resumes, like, okay, this, I'm going after this person, or I'm going after this person. It feels so like a beautiful parallel between how companies decide like who has to go, who has to die, who has their lives turned upside down.
No, it's so dope. And I think we can't stress enough how meticulous this process is. Like yep. you say, like the way that he wants to eliminate his competitors and the research process that goes into it, but then also the process of like basically, you know, investigating their lives, surveilling them, patrolling them, and finding ways to insert himself to basically violently take out all of these competitors. It's done with such rigor, which I find also indeed very cool. And it's bang on what you say about the HR kind yeah. of like lingo that lingers in it, which is, I mean, let's be honest, one of the most violent things is also how in the work field, a lot of people are put in these kind of positions because of this HR, almost Vichy regime, computer says no kind of style of like, you have to submit to our working culture.
For the shareholders.
For the shareholders. And then what you say, which I find very interesting about this class anxiety and how it is linked to shame and to indecision, it's very strong. And I always say that shame is possibly the strongest human emotion we can feel, because it's a very layered one, and it's a very private one, and it's one that people are less willing to talk about. And I always find that cinematically it's one of the most powerful ones to explore, and I am so happy to see that a director like this is able to tackle that exact feeling on such a deep level. And even though the story is so specific, it makes it very universal, right? Because yeah. it's like, aren't we all hyper aware of our anxious position in a world where everybody seems to scheme, steal, cheat their way to the top? Almost that you're thinking, and why am I not doing that? Why am I not drop shipping shit from AliExpress to make a buck? Why did I not buy Bitcoin in 2011? Yeah. Why did I not sell my soul? In that sense, it's a very strong mirror again. And I think Park Chan-wook in that sense really is one of the best directors, especially working in Korea, in the sense that he is so good at mirroring society in strong genre cinema.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and on that note of like, why didn't I? Why am I not? I think a lot of the people that he goes after are people that he sees his own shame in. So he goes after these people, and he kind of sees like the worst version of himself, like the first person he visits, Byung-mo and his wife. He sees this drunk, he sees this cuck, like someone else is fucking his wife. He's all about like analog. He won't give up the paper. He's so passionate about paper to an extent where there's this beautiful moment where this guy compares his wife's lips to the softness of this paper. And you see Mansu just like touching his own lips. He's like, right, yeah, that's so nice. So he basically sees the worst version of himself, like this bum, this burnout, someone else is fucking his wife, and he gets mad at him, and you can see that he's just mad at himself. And the second person is very similar to him. He's a father, he has a daughter, like all of these things. You can see that he has a hard time reflecting on the things that he hates in these people because he hates them in himself, and that he, again, has no other choice but to do the things that he does.
And this is, I think, a key component of class anxiety, and like the strain of capitalism is that very often I think people only feel enabled to assert their own power by basically punching down instead of punching up, meaning that through this trickle-down effect, you know, the people at the bottom, the lower class of society, will always be the butt end of the joke, you know, of this cruel joke, because they are always in the position to receive most of the violence, also from the middle class. And I think this film shows it very well. And one thing about how well the film shows things is that Park Chan-wook has developed this visual language in which he is also so good at showing our relationship with technology. And
yes,
also in Decision to Leave, the previous film he made, he has a couple of, by now you could call them signature shots, in which basically people are, for instance, looking at their phone.
Yeah.
And you see the shot from the POV of the phone looking up at the person looking at the phone, and yep, you can still see the glass facade of the interface of the phone and like the keyboard on which he types and the apps that he is using. But it's done in such a fluid way that I'm just always shocked. How does he do it? It's incredible.
Yeah, and there's also this beautiful shot where they're like showing an iPad and they're kind of like showing it to several people, and you see what's on the iPad, but you also see the reflections of their faces looking at the iPad. And I'm like, I have never seen technology done like this in a movie. Absolutely stunning. And he also does some very interesting editing stuff here where he does like crossfades or...
Whoa, the editing is crazy.
My God, like two people are on the phone and they're just kind of like back to back in like... in a way that I haven't seen before. Like,
and you know what's dope is that Park always works with the same editor already almost through the entirety of his career, often also with the same cinematographer, and that you feel that they together have composed this unique visual language. It's a complete synergy of filmmaking. And
yeah,
I think such a thing can only happen when these collaborators have worked with each other so deeply and are so trusting in each other and basically really stepping up the game in terms of how you represent the complexities of navigating late capitalist digital life. So yes, on a visual level alone, it's an absolute masterpiece.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, maybe you will get lost a little bit in the narrative like me, but at the other end, I will never regret getting lost in a narrative like this.
Yeah.
I'd rather be in a film where I'm at some point like, okay, sure, but then just constantly being surprised by all of these other elements in it, then that I have such a clear, legible film that is streamlined, but that is essentially boring and will not linger. And this is, I think, a film that can linger for a long time for the right reasons.
Exactly, because I'm someone who often has a hard time with a 2-hour 20 movie.
Yeah.
And the thing that I'll do is like at some point I'll feel it. I'll be like, long movie. And then I'll like look at my phone quickly to see like, what's the time? How long do we have left? And here, when that moment hit, I was like, oh, this movie's over in 5 minutes.
Insane. Yeah.
Sick. Like, so I never felt the weight of the length or the snowballing in a way that I wasn't fully on board with it. More, give me more. And yeah, without any spoilers, I think it wraps up so beautifully. I think the ending is great. Something we haven't mentioned before, by the way, which I was going to say, is that it is based on a book by Donald E. Westlake called The Axe. Park Chan-wook, this is basically a project that he's been wanting to make for about 20 years. So in 2005, this movie was already adapted by Costa Gavras, a French movie that's really hard to find. Like, I can't seem to really find it except on, like, French Canal Plus, you can rent it. And the movie is also dedicated to him. So at the end of the movie, when it says dedicated to Costa Gavras, it's because he already made this movie in 2005. And Park Chan-wook has basically spent his entire career wanting to make this movie, but it was never the right time, or something else came up, or Koreans weren't supporting it. But I really feel like sometimes that can go wrong. I know you love Megalopolis, but there's projects like that,
yeah,
when directors like spend their whole lives wanting to make this story and it becomes too precious and it fails because it gets too hammy And I think in this case, it worked out so well because I think it is a story for these times.
Exactly.
It's a story we want in these times.
I couldn't even imagine what this film would look like in 2005 because it is so tied also to our like smartphone capitalism and what that looks and feels like and how it changed our relationship with reality and the virtual and the analog world. I'm always amazed when filmmakers are able to do that, right? To carry a project with them for so long and then actually wait it out till the right moment to actually make it, and then to when they make it, to make it well, and that you feel that all of these intent of these two decades prior is still in the film. This is insanely impressive to me.
And the book is from 97, so then it gives a whole new perspective on this paper thing where it's like 97, start of the internet, there's the huge fears of like paper's gonna disappear. And so that also adds a beautiful layer to it, I think, knowing that it's based on a book from 97. I quickly want to mention the Oscars and the Golden Globes this movie, because it got 3 nods at the Golden Globes. It got a nomination for Best Picture Musical or Comedy, Best Male Musical or Comedy, and Best Non-English Language. Oscars, crickets.
No, I'm not surprised. Maybe also for the reasons that I was a little bit resistant to it. Is, and also, let's be brutally honest, we were talking about the Oscars, but the international picture category this year is insanely stacked. And
that's
you
true.
Have so many films that also for the American mindset speak much more concretely about things that are wrong in the world, like The Secret Agent by Kleber Mendoza Filho, which is, you know, also the reason that we have this Brazil program in Lab 111, or just to name Jafar Panahi, who is of course now the chroniqueur of what is happening in Iran vis-a-vis the Iranian regime and the resentment of the people against it. So there's so many films that seem on the surface to be quote-unquote more important.
Yeah.
And the foreign category of foreign films is very strongly also,
a political
barometer of what people in America find important right now and what they can actually point their attention towards in their oversaturated news cycles. And then the thing that Park Chan-wook was addressing are more easily taken for granted. And maybe also, let's be brutally honest, because many of these mechanisms, a lot of people in the US seem to be more comfortable with the fact that it exists. Mm-hmm. However, that doesn't take anything away from the urgency of the film. As a matter of fact, I would say that the more people are comfortable with this situation we find ourselves in, of automation, of redundancy of jobs, and the hyper-capitalist, individualist, competitive grind set that we all have to go on, the more this film speaks to our times. So in that sense, maybe not being recognized in itself is also kind of the sly recognition of how important this film is right now.
It's hard to remember now, but one of the most iconic movies in horror history, Stanley Kubrick's The Shining, was not immediately well received. Critics and audiences were hostile, saying that it was more cold and strange than actually scary, and even writer Stephen King absolutely hated the movie. It's been 45 years since Jack Nicholson and Shelley Duvall stayed at the Overlook Hotel, and it's back on our screens. Here's a clip.
I think you have some very definite ideas about what should be done with Danny. And I'd like to know what they are.
I think maybe he should be taken to a doctor.
Yeah, it's interesting to reflect on how it was received initially, because I do think now The Shining is such an icon of horror, if only in its like iconography of like anything that exists has parodied the twins in the hall. You know, the carpet, you know,
the elevator, with the blood.
Least once a month, I think about the elevator with the blood, you know.
For what reason? You care to explain?
Here's Johnny, the axe. Like, it's so iconic in so many ways. But Stephen King absolutely hated it because he said that in his novel, it was more about like a man fighting possession. He didn't like that when Jack gets to the hotel, he's already crazy, kind of. So there's a lot of things that people don't like about it. How do you feel about The Shining, Hugo?
Well, let me just respond to what this initial criticism was, because we're recording now, and tonight, actually, I'm giving a lecture on Stanley Kubrick in a cinema in Rotterdam. And when I'm reading books on Kubrick, what is interesting is that most of his films were being perceived as having a coldness and a detachment mm-hmm. towards humanity and the characters in his films. The same criticism has applied to the humans in 2001 A Space Odyssey that, you know, slowly are getting murked by a computer. Yep. Or by on Barry Lyndon, which is one of the most gorgeous historical films ever made. But when people saw it, they said, we don't really like the characters. Or what to think of Alex, the protagonist of A Clockwork Orange, who is a villain. He's an awful, murderous rapist. Of course, he's not a likable person. Even with a great war film like Paths of Glory about the First World War and how basically pointless all the human killing and suffering in it was, people were saying that he was more interested in the spectacle of war itself than in the actual loss of soldiers that are fighting for their lives. So this criticism seems to be attached to Kubrick a priori, and it says a lot about maybe his outlook on humanity. But then always with Kubrick, if you go one step further and you probe it a little bit deeper, it is despite, or actually because of the coldness, that the films become so scary. Because he is not a misanthrope. He does not hate the people in his films. He just shows that people are capable of very cruel things.
Yeah.
And what for me strikes me the most while revisiting The Shining, occasionally, because it's a great film, to be honest, to revisit,
absolutely,
is that the first times when I watched it as a teenager, I watched it just as a scary horror movie. You gotta see it. It's so scary, right? And the most scary parts seem to be the supernatural ones. The ghastly hotel and the demonic entities that seem to haunt it, and the way that it takes hold of Jack Nicholson's character. However, if you revisit the film more and more, the actual horror is Jack Nicholson's character. It's the fact that even before he sets foot in this hotel, he hates his wife. He doesn't like his child. He is abusive. He has violent tendencies. And he has a very escapist nature that he wants to get away from his nuclear family situation. And the way that already manifests itself in the beginning is where the real frights now are for me.
Yeah.
So I love the film because you have this surface level reading of it being a supernatural horror. But then the incredible thing that Kubrick does, as he has done in so many other types of films, is he plays it so incredibly straight that everything around it actually is much more interesting than all the supernatural stuff that he throws at you. So, no, it's still an absolute banner. And all these criticisms have historically been objectively, I would say, proven wrong, with a bit more understanding of where he actually came from.
And I think it's also something that just happens to movies when it's kind of the first of its kind, because I think The Shining is basically just laid the groundwork for what we now cringely call elevated horror.
Yeah.
There's a lot of like things that don't make sense, like continuity errors that seem purposeful, like the typewriter changes color, and it's like all these things that are purposefully disorienting, not explained. When the Stranger Things finale came out, people were saying, like, this can't be the ending to Stranger Things because all of these clues were planted and maybe there will be an ending that is good. And it really reminded me of how people talked about The Shining. It's like, well, there's these tobacco cans behind him, so that means it's a metaphor for Native American genocide, or like there were all these conspiracy theories about it, like the final image at the end. There's even a documentary about it called
237, which is a very funny film.
It's very funny. Like, they just go into like all of these conspiracy theories, but it was kind of the first movie to do that, to like purposefully be like, what do you think that means? Let us know in the comments. kind of
R.I.P. Stanley Kubrick, you would have loved TikTok film discourse. Kubrick was also very smart by adapting a lot of different books throughout his career. As a matter of fact, most of his films are based on books. And what he usually sought for in a book was an insane strong clarity of plot, but also to find source material that in itself is not so masterful that it would be in the way of what he wants to do with the material. And in that sense, he was so great at taking a source material and completely making it his own. And then the rigor and the perfectionism and the deep, deep, deep level of research that he did to make these films, you see it in every shot. Like you say, like every bit that you see in The Shining feels like it's there for a certain purpose or intent, right? And we were talking about Park Chan-wook wanting to make No Other Choice for 20 years. Kubrick was the same type of guy who just walked around with ideas for films in his head that he wanted to make forever and forever and forever. Like he wanted to make a huge film about Napoleon that was on his mind constantly. And actually, that's how he tapped Jack Nicholson, because he wanted Jack Nicholson to play Napoleon.
Wow, we were robbed.
Yes, I know. He once said that if his colleagues in the film industry would call him from some nice beach vacation, he would just say, "Why are you even going on vacation?" Because it would distract you from thinking about the film that you will make.
Gosh.
So he was always in the process
relax.
Of making the film. Yeah, no, he could not relax. Kubrick, and this is a very funny aside, but he always had very monotonous fashion drip. He was basically wearing the same style of like shirt and pants almost his entire career, because he didn't want to think about his outfits. As a matter of fact, even when he was already an adult, his mom was still buying and shipping him clothes because he didn't want to take the time to go to the store himself. He was dedicated to the bit to an extreme amount. And yeah, it's just dope to see that these films that are so ubiquitous and, like you said, referenced so much, when you revisit them, that they're actually still really, really, really good banners, yeah. That they still are like so insane. When is the last time you saw The Shining?
Yeah, I was just saying to Elliot, it's like, I usually always rewatch something before we do an episode, but I feel like I've seen The Shining so many times, as you mentioned, throughout my life, that I didn't feel like I had to revisit it, because I feel like beat for beat, I kind of remember that movie. I think, yeah, it might be time for a rewatch. The thing that's kind of tragic about us doing this podcast is that I rarely go to see movies at Lab 111 anymore, because we screen them. I have to talk about them in the podcast before.
Yes.
And then I usually end up watching screeners at home. And then I realized recently when one of our lovely colleagues here says, like, don't see you around a lot anymore. I'm like, yeah, it's because I don't really have to go see these releases that often. So it's really nice with this one that I'm excited to see it on the big screen. Cause I don't think I ever did. I think I've only seen it at home.
It's in a room with this, in the cinema with the room of people, it hits so hard. Also, by the way, for one specific reason, the sound is crazy. It's so scary. Mm. It's so loud. All this like creepy modernist classical music and these violins that just creep up, but they have like ear shattering levels of volume sometimes. And just this entire film makes you pressed into the seat into such a strong degree. This mastery again of form and how he can play the audience with that. It's incredible. I don't know. It's like Kubrick seems boring at some point because we all know he's great. He's the GOAT and he's easily taken for granted. And then every time you rewatch it, it's like, let's fucking go.
I thought
I was out, but I pulled me back in. It's insane. So yes, The Shining, I would actually love to revisit it on the big screen as well, because it works.
It works
very well.
So yeah, me too. If you want to do that, I totally understand. And you're so welcome to come do that at Lab 111. You can get your tickets at lab111.nl or in the link in the show notes. And the same goes for No Other Choice. Hope to see you there. Stay connected with us at Celebrating Cinema and Lab by following at Lab 111 on Instagram and Letterboxd. Do you love what we do? Support us by leaving a review on your favorite podcast platform. It really helps us climb the ranks of the podcast charts. And don't forget to check the show notes for all the films mentioned, bonus info, and ticket links. This was a Lab 111 production, edited and produced by Elliot Bloom, with music from Hugo Emmertzahl and artwork from Studio FFF.